This is Nighthawk's episode about Dearest Sister. Doesn't have a clever name.
3, 2, 1.
KOKW calling. I'm on international frequency. Come in.
I am Torgo. I take care of the place while the master is away.
He's trying to cheat us, Pepe. All this talk is so he can get a better price, so he can make fools of us.
Yeah, it's so easy to make a fool of me. Why don't you try it sometime?
Well, I got something done. I got a job at Mr. Greenfeld's sporting goods store, and he promised to do anything he can to help me to get to Texas.
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
I had a reason for inviting each guest. I wanted kind of a cross-section. They share one thing. They all need money. Now let's see if they're brave enough to earn it.
And you call this a party?
Could be.
We're back.
Good day to you. Good night to you, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Nighthawks podcast. I'm Trevor T. Trujillo. With me, as always, is the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Matt Foster. Matt, how are you?
I'm all right. I'm almost as big as Kane Hodder, but not as rich.
Well, folks, right off the bat here, I just kind of want to address the elephant in the room. We, for the life of this podcast, have been pretty big boosters for the Alamo Draft House and for specifically Fantastic Fest, which is kind of hosted under the Alamo Draft House brand. Recently, have both of those entities have kind of come under criticism and a fair deal of scandal, I guess you'd say. And it's something that is definitely troubling for us. It's something that we have a lot of complex feelings about, and we're not sure that at this time they're fully parsed, but we did feel that it's an unfortunate situation. It's a wrong situation. It's a very sad, very confusing situation, but ultimately we wanted to do something a little different. So first off, I just want to say we're not going to add anything else to the conversation that's already going on. There's much more qualified people. The conversation is happening on a much more worthy forum, I guess.
Yeah. When Trevor says we're not going to add anything, he means we can't. We're dolts.
Yeah, we are dudes at the corner of White Street and Privilege Boulevard, and our opinion really just doesn't matter, except to say that I do want to put out there that to the victims who have been coming forward and talking about their experiences, that's very courageous. We support you. We believe you. But really, there's nothing that we can add. And I don't want our absence from Fantastic Fest this year to be read as an editorial on that situation. That decision came before the scandal broke.
Yeah, it's kind of, we were talking about how to talk about it, and the honest truth is we had made the decision for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And having done so, the temptation to take the credit for boycotting is there. The temptation to defend all the people we know that are just theater and film festival employees that have nothing to do with this one bag of hair and Vaseline that somehow... No, we're not getting into it.
Yeah.
But obviously, we know a lot of good people that are, you know, just the bartender and the volunteers and the ushers, and we still have a lot of love for them. And so the temptation to scrum in and defend your friends is there. But we can't claim credit either way. The fact is, we decided we had to work.
Yeah, you know, and that's, I think we kind of were parsing this before that we started the record, and it's not an editorial statement that we're not there. It's also not an editorial statement that we're not there. You know, I honest to God do not know how I would have reacted if we had been planning on going when the scandal broke, and there's no way to know.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying is it'd be nice to take the extra credit and say, but we cannot say in retrospect how we would have reacted because we already did a thing.
Right.
Thus disclaimed, we were talking about how and what to do, and well, we think we've come up with a novel approach that will maybe start a friend's Oscar hunt a little early.
Yeah. There's a lot more going on in Fantastic Fest and the Alamo Drafthouse and the Austin film scene than just a couple of key people. And you know, I'll name names. We're talking about Harry Knowles, Tim League, and Devin Faraci, however you may feel about them. While those people are very influential people and people who are very important to that scene and people who are under a great deal of criticism and scrutiny right now, but there's a whole other group of people who are involved, as you said, with the festival, you know, the bartenders, the busboys, the volunteers, and even just the attendees, the fans, the people who are there standing proudly in defiance and in protest and who are there to provide a safe and nurturing environment for their friends. That's really wonderful. And so what we want to do on this episode is talk about one of the success stories to come out of Fantastic Fest. And this news just broke a couple of days ago, but a friend of the podcast, Maddie Doe, who is a filmmaker that works out of Laos, the news has broken through Variety and a couple of other online news outlets that the country of Laos has submitted Maddie Doe's film, Dearest Sister, for consideration to the American Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences for Oscar consideration. Now, there's a long, long path before we even get excited about that. It's great that this is happening, though. Maddie is the only female filmmaker working out of Laos currently. She's the first female horror director working out of Laos currently. She is really working hard to build an industry for film in that country. And it's really exciting to kind of get in on the ground floor and watch this happen. And it's great that Laos has kind of got it put together and they're going to submit this film for Oscar consideration. It's a big deal, but let's not start marking our tablets just yet. Still a long way to go. There's a short list to be confirmed, and then there's the actual list of nominees. So we'll keep you up to date on that, but we do want to talk about this because it's a Fantastic Fest film. Maddie Doe is a wonderful addition to Fantastic Fest. She's been there a couple of times. She's a wonderful, bright, effervescent personality that you just is so addictive. Wherever Maddie is, that's where the party's at. And so we wanted to throw her some love. We wanted to congratulate her on this job well done. So we went ahead and sat down and watched Dearest Sister through the Shudder online streaming service. And we're going to talk about that today. Matt, any preliminary thoughts before we dive in?
I don't know how preliminary this thought is, but this was just kind of the tonic for me because I was, I've been wrestling a lot with the rules of horror, like where we get the conventions of a horror movie. You know, I call it the Winchester physics, the ghosts set off EMPs, salt drives them away, the kind of Western ghost hunting physics that have sort of invaded. And to a lesser degree, that all goes back to the Warrens, The Conjuring, their pop sci work, the books they released in the 70s. So we have this set of expectations about the supernatural, and I've been for a while digging up movies that subvert those a little bit. And like we've talked a little bit before about two other Fantastic Fest movies, The Autopsy of Jane Doe and A Dark Song, which are two movies that get kind of down in a cult. They're more about magic with a K and weird, different supernatural stuff. And this is another one that's coming at it from another cultural angle. It's coming at it from another kind of motivation, the happening.
I was reading a couple of articles in preparation for this, and especially since they made that announcement earlier this week, there's quite a few to pick from. But in a prepared statement that they all kind of quoted from and pulled from, she talks about the difficulties in building this film scene in Laos and how difficult it is to make a film there, in that you don't have a budget, you don't have a ready network of cameramen and riggers, and, you know, you don't have that infrastructure there for filmmaking and crews. And so she talks about how rough that is, but on the flip side of the coin is she's establishing this film scene kind of as she goes along. It's a scene that's in its very nascency. And so she can really get away with doing anything she wants. So she can subvert those Western tropes because she's not a Western filmmaker. She's making films out of Laos now, and she can do whatever she wants. There are no tropes. You look at films that are coming out of Uganda, for example, and how they are a different film experience than from what we're used to, where they have
Trevor.
Yeah.
Everyone is a commando.
But me, I am a doctor. But yeah, you look at what a movie is to the people of Uganda, and it is this cultural, live, theatrical experience where you have a live riff going along and explaining the plot of a film. That's a trope there. That's a thing that exists there and nowhere else. And so it's really interesting to see that evolution beginning to happen in these Lao films, and it's really great because we know Maddie, and you know, we can sometimes get a little bit of inside information and see behind the curtain. But I'm really excited that this has been submitted to the Oscars for consideration. I don't know how far it's going to go. Genre film typically doesn't do well at the Oscars. But this one is just different enough that it could be something really special, and something I hope we're going to be talking about on next year's Oscar special with Cameron.
I guess this one kind of caught me napping.
Yeah?
Because it certainly sets up a different emotional ebb and flow than it ultimately has in the end.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was neat.
We'll throw up a spoiler curtain. We're gonna want to talk about this movie in toto, but... if you haven't seen this, folks, go ahead and you know, see it now on our say-so. It's a very fascinating, very good, very creepy. I don't know what you'd call this, a haunted house movie or it's just a very conceptually different film, and it's very refreshing because of that. So definitely check this out. We'll throw up a spoiler curtain later in the episode.
I should look up these people's names so I'm not just calling them mother and cousin,
boy.
Or wife and cousin.
I don't. You might get some character names, but I'm going to have to confess to a very bad Western tongue here. I don't do well with the Asiatic names, and I'm not even going to try. Folks, these are wonderful people. They deliver fantastic performances. This is a well-put-together film. They deserve every amount of recognition that they can get. However, for me to attempt some of these names would be nothing short of insulting. So I'm not even going to attempt it. I apologize. Mea culpa. But I think the character names might be a little easier to swing.
Amphiphone Famapunya playing Nock, and Valona Fetmani playing Anna.
Yeah, you're doing better than I did.
We also have Tembet Tuisk, which is probably the one I mangled the worst, who is Estonian. He plays Jacob, the kind of interloping gringo. But we have the country girl, Nock, who has been sent to help out her cousin, Anna, who is a bit more of a city mouse, and who is married to an NGO worker from outside of Laos named Jacob. The dynamic when she gets there is that she does not know her cousin Anna well, and the dynamic is not good. She is in a weird sort of liminal space between the house's butler and cook, who are a couple, and the actual occupants of the house. So she's somewhere sandwiched between a servant and a guest. But she's sent to kind of provide some daytime companionship and help for her cousin who's going blind, and it's kind of more that her family thinks it's a good idea. And then there's also the dynamic where I believe she's being reimbursed somehow, and so Anna thinks she's sort of helping out the family by paying her, but there's a real through line here where money is a little bit toxic. That's kind of the basic. That's the chessboard with the pieces on it. But what unfolds is a little more complex than that.
Well, and it gets complex because there is a supernatural element. And it's that this woman who is going blind, this malady seems to allow her to see dead people. When she's in these states, it's she's unclear of the motivation of some of these spirits that are visiting her. The visiting country mouse, the Knock character, manages to kind of put it together in that it is not necessarily a malicious spirit. It's one that is kind of sending a message from beyond, and she manages to put it together to her personal gain, while also shirking her obligations and her familial duties. In that, we have one of my favorite parts of this film was how complex the characters are. Genuinely, if you were to try and put this on paper with just a typical movie, none of these characters are particularly likable. They all do some really, really heinous shit to each other. But at the same time, and this is not easy to do, and not all movies manage to do this when they have this many unlikable characters in one place, you're still invested in the story. Even though they're not likable, you still want to see where this goes, because they all have examples of being redeemable, decent people. And so you're interested to see which way they're going to swing.
The comparison I made was to Breaking Bad, where Walter White does not particularly do good things, but the actor portraying him so successfully projects his personality that while you're watching, you share his morality. And there's a lot of that going on here because, how to put this, you initially follow Knock, and she is sort of set up as the Cinderella. Right? Like, she's a country girl. They're kind of mean to her when she gets there. And she starts to make some friends there. And they start to encourage her to get out there and see the world and bloom a little bit. And you think you know where it's going. And then it takes a hard right turn on you.
We talk about a slow burn rather than a long fuse. This is definitely a slow burn. There's a lot going on to keep you motivated, to keep you watching. But man, it does have a very explosive, like, final 10 minutes where some unexpected things happen and some people show. It is one of those movies where by the end of it, you're kind of left catching your breath and going, man, what just happened, you know?
The karmic knot in the middle of this movie is pretty intricate and cool. I enjoyed the resolution of this, and I was walking along thinking, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, I'm a jaded person, I know, and I know where this is going. I am the man. I've read Save the Cat. I know how movies end. This one zinged me a little bit, not with particularly, like, it's not explicit content time. It's not that kind of an issue. It's not that it goes somewhere unusually dark. It's that, it truly has a different moral core and lesson than you think it does when you start watching it.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, it's strange. When this played at Fantastic Fest, there was another movie playing at the time. It's unfair to really compare the two because they're coming from two different cultural places. But there was a film at Fantastic Fest called Sweet, Sweet Lonely Girl that dealt with a lot of the same themes and a lot of even the same plot points. And it was a movie about a young girl who was sent to take care of an infirm elder. I think in that case it was an aunt as well. She takes care of this elder. Well, what happens in both films is that there's a little bit of corruption of our Cinderella character, or our main...
No, it's accurate to call her a protagonist. She's not particularly the hero.
Yeah, okay, there you go, that's fair. I don't want to get caught bad-mouthing another movie, because Sweet, Sweet Lonely Girl has some fantastic things going for it. The performances are wonderful. It's well put together. There's a lot going for it. However, just when it comes to story and script, I think Dearest Sister nails it so much better and kind of drives that point home, talking about that greed and corruption and seduction of the innocent kind of thing. I think the Laos setting actually assists that, because you have such a difference between the impoverished people and then this NGO Westerner who has come in and taken his Lao wife and is now living very well-to-do And so you have that interesting dynamic right there. You've got the dynamic of in the country of Laos for, you know, sex tourism or to find themselves an Asian bride to bring home, which is also a situation that's addressed. And so I think just the setting is so much more rich and lush for that kind of story.
Well, and there's a strong through line of just general class commentary because, you know, the husband is not an evil man per se, but he almost can't. It's like I was listening to a podcast about I think it was Ari Shaffir traveling in Thailand, where he talks about like bargaining in a night market for some food. And he realizes, like, he's been arguing with a woman for 10 minutes about a dime.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so there's this element in this where it's the similar, legitimately trying to do his best, he can't help but leave kind of footprints. And just in the course of waving his money around, he's an accidental dick quite a bit.
Well, and then he's also a specific dick. We're never really given the particulars of what his NGO does. You know, it has something to do with solar panels and kind of building a kind of an energy infrastructure.
The impression I got was that they were supposed to be installing something specific, and they were going with installing Chinese knockoffs of what they were supposed to be installing and pocketing the difference.
Uh-huh.
There's a through line of just money is poison in this. Like there's the richer someone is, the worse they act in it, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
The only half exception is there's the character Kenji. He's one of Jacob's,
At one point mentions that he's the numbers guy. He's the accountant and that he has all the financial records for the NGO.
At one point, Nock kind of wanders off in the red light district and he sort of plays the hero because he gets her out of the situation. But then the other fact of that is he was there.
You know,
he was at the sketchy club. So there's not a lot of lovable, huggable characters here, which is fine. They're complete. Mm-hmm. They're not central casting people. The sort of through line that goes on with the couple that are the household servants, where they're a little resentful toward Nock at first, then a lot resentful, then they sort of trade places, and then I don't want to get too much into the climax, but they have a lot of weird role reversals.
Relationships in this are very dynamic, and they're always kind of changing. When you look at the character of Nock and the character of Anna, and how Anna starts off very cold. She's talking about how she doesn't even know who this woman is. She's feeling very independent. She's losing her vision, but she doesn't necessarily want to admit it. She doesn't feel the need to have somebody around kind of babysitting her. And so she's very standoffish and cold, but through a series of differing events, the two begin to bond and begin to address each other as sister. So there's some more role reversal even after that, where suddenly they're not getting along. It's all done very well, and that's the slow burn. You know, you're not getting jump scares, you're not getting real intense moments, but you're getting a lot of passion, a lot of emotion, and it's well paced, and you get that up and down of these dynamic relationships, and that really keeps the movie moving.
Their relationship is really kind of oddly, I don't know if I'd say codependent, but Anna wants Nock around, but she wants to discuss certain things. Like, she kind of wants her around for girl talk and a sympathetic shoulder, but not always.
Uh-huh. Well, and there's also some judgment from Anna's social circles. Anna herself, she's becoming very reclusive and very kind of a shut-in, and her friends are often trying to drag her out into public. You know, let's go out to lunch, let's go out to tea. Well, once Nock arrives, Nock is coming along with them, and there is some, like, seriously unguarded, just, you know, flagrant, bitchy, kind of mean girl's behavior that is directed towards Nock. And you feel bad for Nock because that's a very unfortunate situation. But Nock herself is kind of playing for herself, and we'll get more into that as we get behind the spoiler curtain. But
and then Anna does some decision making where she doesn't even quite tell everybody that it's a family member.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. she sort of she sort of lets them think it's another maid or something. Assumptively, she's from the same village, and she doesn't really want it discussed. So there's some strong roots shaming going on that has to do with, of course, the sort of notionality of these ghosts that she's seeing. And she sees the ghosts in times of kind of stress, during like social stress, or like when there's some contention around the furniture being moved by the maid. And she trips over it and falls. And in the falling, Nock is helping her up and talking to her. And that's where it comes out that these the ghosts are kind of whispering things to Anna. And that's where it gets kind of, I don't know, we're kind of up against that spoiler curtain.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and throw that up? Folks, seriously, check out this movie. It's really fantastic. And I guess in its own special way is already generating Oscar buzz. So, definitely check it out. Available through, I think, exclusively through Shudder, which currently I have as an add-on to my already existing Amazon Prime streaming. It's a real cheap service. I think it's about half of what you'd pay for Netflix. We're not, by the way, sponsored or getting paid or reimbursed in any way by Shudder. We're actually just fairly impressed with the service lately. So, yeah, folks, check this out. Well worth your time. Matt, anything else to add before we throw up that spoiler curtain?
Just that if you work for Shudder and you'd like to change that situation, like, we will take your Shudder money. Like that stuff he just said about liking the service, that doesn't mean we're above it. We are not too good here at Nighthawks.
All right, well, let's throw up that spoiler curtain. So here we are on the other side, Matt. What do the good people need to know? Because we're behind the spoiler curtain. We've all seen the movie now. That's what we're supposed to do now. So last chance, if you haven't seen the movie, bail now and go watch it. But there's some questionable motivation going on in Dearest Sister, especially from our protagonist.
Yeah, what's going down here, when the ghost shows up, the ghost is very creepy, but the ghost is probably some sort of, I would say, ancestor or divine presence. Trevor and I are appallingly uneducated on religions other than and including Christianity. There are some sort of overtones of, like, when Nock goes by, like, the Buddhist temple, she kind of recoils and demonstrates some visible superstition and guilt. And so there's some... I took it to be, in a play on the title, I thought perhaps it was some relative or something. But the ghost comes. When the ghost is around, it starts whispering in Anna's ear. And she starts sort of involuntarily, in a sort of pseudo-possession, repeating what it's telling her, and what it's telling her are numbers. And Nock takes the numbers that Anna's repeating in kind of a coma, a fugue state, and she takes them and plays them at the state lottery. Begins winning a bunch of money, and then, since Anna can't remember what happened, she's able to kind of separate how it's all going down, but then she has to justify where her money's coming from. The money from nowhere kind of starts poisoning the dynamic even worse. And then it's kind of revealed that the husband is in the middle of some bad business, probably going to lose his job, might be going to prison, might face some violent reprisal from associates. Then Anna's pregnant. He wants her to flee with him, and she doesn't want to. And so the way I read this movie, and I think you're with me, is that you go into it thinking that the money from heaven is for Nock. That it's for her, that it's fairy godmother, that she's given a chance to get even with these rich girls.
Right.
And then you kind of realize that the ghost can see down the timeline. I'm making a broad down the timeline gesture no one can see.
Right.
Well,
and it does kind of portend the future too. She sees kind of the dead images of people who are still alive the day of their death.
Doesn't see them per se. She perceives them to be, and the one of them is someone she's out of touch with, and she thinks it's a ghost. And then increasingly it becomes more and more apparent that they're coming to her before they die, until finally one of them is someone who's still in the room with her at the very climax, you know. And so it gets where it's all one big knot, and you figure out that the money from heaven, the gift of fate, is sort of supposed to be for both of them to get out of the whole situation.
Right.
Right? Except that they can't cooperate. The more sort of monetary corruption they allow into their lives, the more greed they allow into their lives, the less they cooperate, and until one of them kind of robs the other, ceases to trust the other, and in the end they end up sort of in a mutually assured destruction situation. Final spoiler alert, there's no good ending here.
Well, I think you put it really well when we were pre-gaming, and you said that really what you have to do is look at this from the point of view from the ghost, as kind of a benevolent family figure that's trying to extricate these two girls out of this situation. And the only thing that they have to do to make it work is act like family. And they're so close to doing that, but once you bring money into the situation...
Well, and I guess ghost isn't even quite the right word. It's more like an agent of fate. Like, because it's psychopompic. It's not a particular ghost. It's images of the dead. Then eventually the soon to be dead. So it's this very kind of, I hesitate to crudely use the term karma, but it's sort of agent of fate warning them against hubris.
Yeah.
And they ultimately miss the lesson and thus miss their chance to get out of their mutually poor situation. I thought that whole idea where you're set up to believe that Anna is the evil stepsister, when really her caution is ultimately justified. She did let a stranger into her house who was not necessarily completely kind to her. Also, the idea that it was right there for them to get out of it all, and all they had to do was cooperate.
Well, and especially with this situation going down with the Jakob character, you get the impression, and like I said, they never expressly tell you what's gone on or what he's done, but you pick up enough from context to understand that not only has he done something illegal that's about to be found out, he's done this before, and there are places that he can't go back to because of it. And so really, that's another angle on it where this character is just not likable. But as goes Jakob, so goes Anna, and as goes Anna, so goes Nock. You're invested in what comes of him.
The weird thing about Jakob is all the bad stuff he does is introduced through exposition. All his actual conduct within the movie is fairly upright. Like he wants his wife to get better. He wants his unborn kid to be safe. He wants, you know, he's not really, his motivations are fairly explicable. And so he doesn't come off that bad, even though he's clearly caught doing some bad stuff. Which is, again, part of the delicacy of the characterization here, where you don't hate any of these people for how ordinary they are, how, I guess, banal they are. They do disappointing things, but they're not evil.
So ultimately, Matt, we've been tiptoeing around the very end. Is there anything specifically that seemed to really resonate with you?
I just thought it was a really good metaphor for how we kind of just screw ourselves up. We don't drop what needs to be dropped. We don't bury what hatchets need buried, and we don't help ourselves sometimes. And in the end, neither one of them will kind of stop being stubborn. And they just go down together, and in fact, I believe they neatly kind of kill each other.
At least that's what's implied. It ends up happening off screen, but
you know, Nock makes a choice to go after Anna to sort of clean the situation up and maybe get out of it with no legal liability. Anna is warned this is going to happen by the supernatural presence, so even though she's blind, she's been shown exactly what's about to happen in the next few seconds. Because she's involved in the vision and she sort of knows what is about to happen, she kind of has the option to surrender to it or to even try to talk Nock out of it. But instead, she plays directly into events and they end up mutually killing each other.
Well, and what's...
just mortally wounding each other within a few seconds, you know.
And I do want to mention that the role reversal that comes at the climax of this film, in that Nock is the one that you're kind of hoping turns things around, that she gets her act together and starts making some good choices, because she makes some really pitiful, pretty disgusting choices in this. But you're hoping that she's going to pull through. Well, by the end of it, she breaks bad. She goes full movie villain by the end of this movie. And in a rather, I guess, sick but also brilliant move, essentially keeps Anna hostage by continuously moving the furniture in the house. After Anna has undergone a surgery to restore her eyesight and is now completely blind. And so she's basically holding Anna hostage until Anna can cough up some new lottery numbers, because there's been some money lost in the meantime.
She knows that the gravy train's running out one way or another, because the operation is a success. So when her eyes are healed and the bandages come off, it's probably all done.
Right. Because her malady, that the blindness, is what allows her to see these otherworldly figures.
And so by ratcheting up the stress level in the household and getting more and more individual incidents to happen, she thinks she can kind of hit it before it's gone, you know.
Right.
Get her score and get out of there. Well, I think it does get to the point of actually keeping her locked in the building. I mean, it's pretty disturbing. I mean, I watched Mother this week, so I'm not I'm no longer flappable, but it gets pretty intense in the end, and it's just a different idea. It's more of a it ended up being more of a like a supernatural fable than a straight haunting.
I do want to talk a little bit about the major domo of the household. You've got the maid, and then you've also got a gardener character that you... And they're kind of a weird X factor in this, and I like that they're in here, but it is a weird little B story that probably wasn't necessary, but once again, I'm glad it's in here because it totally works. And they're just another layer of kind of morally ambiguous, even to a certain degree, social commentary that... Even though these are the put-upon poor people that are having to work in the household, they're kind of dicks, too. And some of that might be deserved, because Nock and Anna are in a position above them only by virtue of the fact that Anna has married a white person. And so there's some animosity there, and there's some class distinction there that... Maybe Anna and Nock are exercising that the household members are not real keen about. And so it's an interesting power dynamic, but even they are not. And there's even a moment where they get fired because they threw a party in the house while Anna was getting her vision restored. I think they go to Thailand, they go to Bangkok. And that's a situation that would have happened anyway, regardless of if Nock was there or not. So I really feel like the domestic members of the household were actually just kind of scuzzy people. And really, if anybody in this movie is just totally irredeemable, I think it would be them. They're the ones that I felt the least amount of sympathy for.
Well, and who are they in the economic model of the movie? They're the collaborators.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, money can't corrupt you if you don't take it, but of course you're going to.
Right.
Because that's the flip side of it, is the reason money is able to corrupt you is because you need it to live, so offering you a bunch of it works. And so that's the core of their dynamic, is that even as they're judging Anna and Nock, they're taking the same money. Even though the girls are not good to them, that does kind of pull some of the rug out from under their judgment, and that and the way they treat some of their, their friends and their guests and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a moment where Anna, when it kind of is revealed what has been going on, and Anna feels very betrayed. So she kind of puts Nock in. She's like, "Well, I don't want you to be here as my caregiver and my sister, but we're going to keep you around long enough to pay what you owe me back." And so she basically kicks Nock to go live with the servants. Well, the servants don't like her either. And they're especially cruel to her. They're not making her dinner. She's having to dig scraps out of the garbage. And so poor Nock really does run the gamut from real bougie kind of fancy girl in Laos to really scraping the bottom of the barrel trying to get by. But again, it's, as you point out, it's all through hubris. So I guess the long way of what I'm talking around, and I'm starting to ramble now, but I mean, these characters are just beautifully rendered and beautifully complex and really well performed. I don't know that there was necessarily a bad performance in this movie.
No, and the whole ensemble works very well. Nobody really rang any hollow notes in particular. And having praised the movie, we get now to something kind of remarkable about it. This movie was made for roughly the same amount of money as The Blair Witch, you know, which is kind of cool.
Well, and you know, that's another thing worth pointing out is the amount of money that they're winning at this lottery. And they're talking about, you know, 2.5 million kip or 5 million kip. And granted, exchange rates can get kind of screwy, and what you can buy with a dollar in the U.S. is not necessarily what you can buy with that same amount of buying power in Laos. But we're talking roughly about, I think at one point she wins like $300, and then the next time she wins $600. And even for people like Anna, that's a life-changing amount of money. You can do something with that and go out and live on that.
The Laotian GDP per capita is $2,300. Like what I was saying earlier about the interloping Estonian guy, that's a point where you can just flip too much money out of your wallet and disrupt the people around you. That introduces a very odd dynamic into it.
Well, and it's funny because you're given the impression that the amount of monies that he's been dealing with, kind of cooking his books, is into the hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars.
That gets into the whole reason there are expatriate communities in these countries. The entire concept of if you can get paid in dollars and you can spend baht or kip somewhere, then you're increasing the volume of your income on the exchange rate. That's the whole appeal of expatriation. This movie does a good job of making you go, about that without beating on it to the point that you feel lectured. Like it's there. You can draw your own conclusions. It's not afraid to look at it realistically as it is, but it's leading you to water. It's not preaching. And I like those aspects a lot.
I think that about wraps it up for me. Do you have any closing thoughts?
You should check this out. This is something maybe 10 or 15 years ago you might never have heard about if it didn't make it all the way to the final cut at the Oscars, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, what, like the meme of the old guy from The Simpsons, or is it Scruffy the janitor? No, we live in a gilded age.
You know? No, and it really is a success story that came out of Fantastic Fest. And, you know, not to kick a dead horse, but you talk about the controversy that's happening over there. And then the part of it you don't see is that sense of community. Maddie is a friend and is somebody that we have gotten to know by virtue of the fact that Fantastic Fest was able to bring a filmmaker there and put her in front of an audience. And then she had, you know, the grace to stick around and hang out with the fans and get to know us. And it's why I'm having such a hard time with what's gone on, because it's something that I wouldn't trade my life for. It's such a fantastic opportunity, but I also recognize now, which has been my male ignorance, but I recognize now that this has not been quite the, I don't know, not quite the fun and games that I thought it was, that there was a lot of people still hurting. And so it's a weird conflict, but I really do want to shine a spotlight on something good that's come out of Fantastic Fest. Having a friendship with Maddie and being able to see these movies and being able to watch the Lao film scene begin to grow and blossom is really, really been a treat. I do want to throw out a quick shout out to the film River. This one's more of a thriller and it's kind of a survival thing. Maddie was the Lao producer on this. And it's another good one worth checking out if you can track it down. I think it was on Netflix not too long ago. I'm not sure if it still is now, but find that.
Did we want to just talk a little bit of, I don't know if this qualifies for our cream of the stream feature or not, but we did make a note to plug Shudder a little bit.
Yeah, before we do that, I do want to talk about Maddie's first film, which is Chanthali, which was another Fantastic Fest movie. Something really cool that Maddie's done with this, Matt, and I think you were a little taken with this when I mentioned it, is that Chanthali was also made for a very low budget, and it's also another movie well worth checking out. Go track it down. And this one's going to be easy to track down, folks, because as part of the fundraising campaign for Dearest Sister, what they had is if they made a stretch goal of a certain amount of money, what Maddie would do would be to open source Chanthali, which is to put it in the public domain. And she's also made all of the raw materials that went into the production of that film available. So you could conceivably take all of those raw materials and produce your own cut of the film and do it without fear of infringing on copyrights, because she's made it available in the public domain, which I think is spectacularly cool.
Yeah, if you have ever tried to teach yourself to edit film or tried to take a class in it, that is a resource of quite some value. It is a little hard to get to just jump into editing and not have to shoot a bunch of content yourself,
mm-hmm.
or re-edit something copywritten, or somehow get raw roll some other way. And this is a pretty cool idea. It's a perfect crowdsourcing goal. It's something that's less commercial and more something unique exists because of crowdfunding, rather than just using it as a pre-sale system or a way to viralize your synergies. I guess stuff is aged into the public domain.
Yeah.
But explicitly to put the whole package out there at once for you to use without a fight is a neat service to film.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, we did want to, since we've been talking about Shudder and we haven't done a cream of the stream in a while, we just kind of wanted to talk about, and again, this is an actual sincere endorsement. We're not being paid, but we wanted to talk about Shudder and how f***ing well they've been doing. For a service that's half the price of Netflix, we're getting a lot of original content. You hear about Shudder picking up a lot of these festival darling films that sometimes may not necessarily have gotten a release. We were kind of joking, but it's true. You could actually put together a rudimentary Fantastic Fest with titles that played previous Fantastic Fests just on the Shudder library alone. There's a lot of fantastic stuff here. It's not all horror, although horror is a centerpiece. There's some just generally good genre fare in here as well.
Throw this up here. I have Shudder open.
Okay.
I have. I Saw the Devil.
Nice.
It's a great, challenging movie. I have Takashi Miike's Audition.
Ooh, that's
great,
another challenge.
Challenging
yeah.
movie. I have Splinter, a slept-on monster movie where a sort of alien parasite traps these people out in a, I believe it's a gas station in the middle of nowhere.
I'm going to throw out a shout-out to Yoheni O'Meara's Grand Piano, starring Elijah Wood and John Cusack. That's on Shudder. Highly recommend that movie. That's one of the movies that I show just about everybody when I'm trying. It's accessible. It's thrilling, suspenseful, and you know, pretty easy to deal with. We've got the remake. I saw the trailer for this this weekend, Matt. The remake of Flatliners is coming out soon with Ellen Page. If you want to catch up, the original Flatliners with Julia Roberts, Kiefer Sutherland, and yes, Kevin Bacon, that is on Shudder. Like I was saying, it's not all horror films. Some of these are just good genre fare. For example, Battle Royale. Folks, check this one out. It's a movie out of Japan. If you liked The Hunger Games, this is more Hunger Games than The Hunger Games. That one's well worth checking out.
Let the Right One In.
Wonderful.
The Pulse. Creepy. One of the original creepy Japanese movies. You know,
I believe the entire REC trilogy is available on Shudder. If you're not familiar with REC, you need to be. This is one of those movies that gets zombies correct, and it's also another movie that's kind of found footage and does that very well too.
The REC movies were at least the first few were loosely remade as the quarantine films.
Yeah,
in English
and. Weak sauce. It didn't work. I did not care for the quarantines.
We have the collector and the collection. If you have a psycho killer shaped place in your heart, like if you've been missing a good Saw or you know, a good movie with a human villain, collector and the collection are pretty well done. Compliance, which is a super creepy movie.
Oh, yeah. Compliance is just uncomfortable.
Sort of ripped from the headlines where a weird prank caller was getting fast food managers to search their employees. And just an odd, odd true case.
And, you know, I'm going to call out a friend of the podcast. Pat Healy plays the voice on the end of the telephone in that film. That was around the time Compliance came out, I think, in 2012. And then Cheap Thrills came out right after that in 2013. And The Innkeepers was kind of in there as well, the Ty West film. And if you just watch those three performances from Pat Healy, you'll see what a fantastically well-rounded actor this guy is. I also want to give a shout-out. There's some good documentaries on Shudder. Crystal Lake Memories is the complete oral history of Friday the 13th in that franchise, which we will be discussing soon. And I do believe Never Sleep Again, which is the similar style documentary, which is about the history of the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. I also want to give a shout-out. As we are entering into the Halloween season, Shudder is going to be a good value for you because you got a lot of good horror movies in here. I'm going to throw out a recommendation on this show for the film Let Us Pray, and that's P-R-E-Y. Let Us Pray very nearly was discussed during our Monstoberfest that we had 2 years ago. I'm not going to tell you which episode it was going to be on because the reason we jettisoned that particular movie for that particular episode was it would have been a major spoiler to talk about it thematically like that. And so I'm going to tell you it would have fit in with one of them. You just have to kind of figure out by watching it which one it would have gone with. But fantastic movie that really was kind of slept on, and I really think people should check out this season. All right, Matt. Well, I think that's it's about going to wrap it up for me. You have any last words for the people out there?
That felt like a pretty good final digression to me.
Yeah. So we're gonna sign off. Stay tuned. Watch this space for details. Hoping to get you some special October time programming in the weeks to come. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, if you're listening to this in a timely manner, which hey, if you're not, no big deal. We're not judging. But to all of our friends that did manage to make it to Fantastic Fest this year, we're glad you're there. It's been great hearing all the news and a lot of stories of positivity and of being a very welcoming environment. We like to hear that. But obviously, this is a very complex issue, one we're not going to parse out and solve here. It's good to hear from them. And we also want to get behind and support the people who decided to not go after the fact. You know, we're with you too, and we love you too, and we hope that we can just be one big supportive family. So that being said, I think I'm Trevor T. Trujillo.
And I'm Matt Foster.
Check us out on Facebook. Check us out on Twitter. Follow us on iTunes. Subscribe. Check us out on Stitcher. We're just all over the damn place. So find us around and get in touch. Let us know what you think about the show. And if you like it, tell somebody. Tell your friends. Share us. That does us probably more good than anything.
This is Precious Roy. Watch a movie.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to sign off because it's almost morning.